Say what you had for breakfast.
For breakfast today, I had granola with peaches and yogurt.
You are so wholesome.
I try to be during the week, and then I'm very unwholesome over the weekend.
Got it. That makes sense. You do a lot of cooking, though. Like,
I do.
You actually cook a lot.
Yeah.
You don't just pretend.
No, I like it. I mean, because in my family, it was forbidden because it was sort of like seen as like the biggest waste of time ever was cooking growing up. So like my parents always went out to restaurants. So for me, it was just cooking was this revelation of how fun it could be.
I have so many questions.
Okay.
Like what if they thought it was a waste of time, but they went to restaurants, did they think that the peasants in the kitchen were wasting their lives?
Oh, wow. No, I think they thought of themselves as peasants themselves who made it out of the kitchen and didn't have to be in the kitchen.
Got
but you
it.
Wouldn't want to be in the kitchen.
I see.
So I think
see.
Culturally it was just seen as like a step back
yeah.
to cook. And also it was gendered. I mean, I think the idea of a man cooking in my family growing up in the Jewish community I grew up in was not smiled upon.
Oh my gosh.
So it was forbidden for me in a lot of different ways. It was like class, gender, sexuality. It's like cooking became this like incredible galvanizing thing for me because it was sort of the ultimate rebellion.
Yeah, it seems like it was almost subversive.
Yeah,
super for you to become a good cook.
That's why like when I cook every night, it's like people are like, wow, you cook every night. And it's like, yeah, I do, because I think it's so fun and cool and great.
That's amazing.
Thanks.
Hey, everybody. I'm talking to Adam Roberts. I'm Catherine Spires, your host. You're listening to Smart Mouth. Hi, Adam.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. I'm so glad that we're here and that we met your cute little new dog, Winston.
I know. Does he get to be on the podcast, too? Or?
Yeah. I mean, my dog, Matilda, always is. So if he makes noise, that's, yeah.
Okay.
We're a dog-friendly space.
I don't think he will bark unless the evil raccoon that sometimes walks past our window walks past and then he'll bark.
Yeah. So. Then all bets are off.
Yes, exactly.
So Adam, as we were just discussing, you grew up cooking and you made that into a job for a while.
Sort of. I grew up in a house with that was obsessed with food. So I grew up in Boca Raton, Florida, in Long Island, New York, to a Jewish family.
Okay.
And they loved restaurants. They loved eating out. But we never cooked at home. And then I went off to college, and that's when I discovered cooking.
I see.
So it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I started.
Okay.
And then I couldn't stop.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You started a blog.
Yes.
Would you say you were sort of one of the early food bloggers?
Yes, I pride myself in being in the old guard of food bloggers. I mean, it really felt like, I mean, when I started a food blog, I didn't know what a food blog was.
Right.
It wasn't a thing. It was just, there were blogs and I just started cooking and my friends at the time who were more savvy than I was were like, you should do a blog about food. And I thought, oh, because it was such a novel take on it too, because it was sort of, I was messing up all the time. I was setting things on fire. And so I was like, oh, I'll do this blog about not knowing how to cook and learning along the way. So if you go into the archives of the Amateur Gourmet, you'll see just disaster after disaster after disaster.
Oh my gosh, and that's fun though.
Yeah, and that was in 2004, so it's been about 14 years.
Yeah, and then cookbooks came after that. But then you moved to Los Angeles.
Yes, I did.
Started writing for television.
Yes.
Was that on purpose?
Yes and no. I went to grad school for dramatic writing. So
I
went to NYU, which is where I met my partner, Craig. And I should say husband, right? Partner's weird.
Well, you guys are married,
We
right?
are married. So, but I've also like heard people like bristle at the word partner because it sounds like a business partner. So whatever word
oh,
it is.
I see.
Yeah, my life mate.
You're not husband, business partner.
Person, not business partner, Craig. So I met him at NYU in grad school. He was in the film school. I was in the dramatic writing program. And basically, I was studying playwriting there when the food blog took off. So I had this background in comedy writing, but I was then became a food writer for about 10 years. So I wrote a book and I wrote another book and I worked for the Food Network for a while. So meanwhile, Craig was having his film career and at a certain point he needed to move to LA. So we moved here together. I thought I could keep being a food writer here and I found it very difficult.
Okay. Well, that's clearly something I want to ask you more
yeah.
about as a food writer in Los Angeles.
No, I know. I felt like we should definitely talk about it, but I found it harder to make it work for myself here. Also, food blogs were not making as much money around that time too. Starting to like the advertising I had had on the blog
wasn't
generating as much as it had. So I sort of was in a crisis and I needed to find a job. So I got a TV agent and I got staffed on The Real O'Neills, which was an ABC show.
I loved that show.
Oh, great. Thanks.
But don't make it sound like it was easy. You're like, I got an agent and then was on a TV show.
No, believe me, like I've learned subsequently that it's not easy at all. But at the time it felt super easy. Like I was just kismet, like got the agent, got the meeting, and then got staffed. And everyone I knew was like, that is crazy. That will never happen again. And sure enough, they were right. Like the show ended and now, you know, I'm still trying to go out for things, but it's much harder now on this end of it. So yeah, I was lucky.
Yeah. I mean, it was lucky because that was a good show and it was sad that it was short lived. But
oh yeah, I mean, it was 2 years and I felt like I got to go to like, I mean, I'd already gone to grad school for writing, but going to work in a writer's room was extraordinary in how much I learned in those 2 years. Right. It was like boot camp.
Right.
Because you couldn't, it was sink or swim. If you weren't funny and you weren't good, they would ask you to leave. So I was very lucky that I got through that and did okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But now that you're not actively working on a show, I mean, is it because you aren't actively working on a show that you started your newsletter?
It's a combination of a lot of things. I mean, I had a hard time once I became a TV writer thinking about what my food career meant, because I was sort of like, whoa, like I spent 10 years of my life writing about food. Now I'm writing for TV and that all feels irrelevant.
Okay.
And so like I stupidly changed my Twitter name from Amateur Gourmet to Hey Adam Roberts, because I was like, that's my name now. You know, I'm a TV guy, I'm not Amateur Gourmet, but now like now I'm on the other end of it. I'm like, wait, that was so stupid. Like I spent 10 years building this food career. Why would I throw that all away? So right now, you know, I'm developing shows and I'm writing screenplays, but I'm also thinking about the food stuff that I've done and wanting to like bring some of that back. So I started my newsletter again, which sort of feels like the perfect way to sort of stay in touch with my readers who want to hear from me.
Yeah.
Without the high stakes nature of like writing blog posts that get like scrutinized and examined.
I see.
So like a newsletter just sort of feels like a nice way to sort of keep writing about food, which by the way is so easy for me to do because I cook, like you said, I cook all the time.
Yeah.
So I just realized like, wow, I have all this content I'm creating that I'm not doing anything with. So I should put it out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully like with a newsletter, that's like the ultimate buy-in. People aren't seeing the newsletter unless they extremely specifically signed up for it.
Yeah. So. Although I'm like nonstop, like linking to it on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook.
It's sure,
like,
but they still have to click the link.
Yeah, they do. But you know, it's so fun because it's like when I was a blogger towards the end, it felt like it had gotten so business oriented. Like all my friends who were bloggers would talk about, I don't remember the word anymore, like not SLR, it's like
SEO.
SEO. Yeah, God. I was confusing cameras with blogging. SEO. And so like I was just obsessed. Like I was titling my posts in certain ways that would get the most traffic. And it was so pointless because I was never going to be Smitten Kitchen or David Leibovitz in terms of getting that kind of traffic because people didn't see me as the authority on food in the same way. My whole thing was that I was like a comedy guy who was sort of being irreverent about food.
Right. I mean, you put amateur right in your name.
It's in my name. And so like I loved doing it. I had so much fun and it was so great to interact with readers and get my stuff out there in the world. But I also realized that there was a limit to how far that could go. And so I, you know, it was sort of a natural transition into comedy writing and TV stuff while still being interested in food. It's like, I don't want to be a blogger anymore.
Right.
This is turning into like a therapy session,
by the way. Which I love. when you were writing on The Real O'Neills, were there ever any times like in the writer's room where there would be a scene that had food in it and there would be a reference to food and someone would say something incorrect and you had to pipe up and be like, that's actually not accurate? I ask this because anytime I'm watching a TV show and I remember this happening on The Mindy Project and they say something like, oh, I love pho with the curly noodles.
Right.
Like there's always these little errors and it always totally takes me out of it. There's very few people who would get so upset about something like that.
No, I had to bite my tongue a little bit, though, because it's sort of like I was a staff writer and then a story editor, which was pretty low on the totem pole.
Okay.
So I would have to choose my moments. But absolutely, yes, for sure. Anytime there was anything, like if there were like if there was a Thanksgiving episode, which there was, and so I was cooking in it, like I would be like, oh, wow, like it takes a lot longer for a turkey to cook than, and I would have to just be like, don't say that, Adam, don't do it, because like everyone's going to hate you because they're like in draft number 6 and they're going to the table, you know.
I see.
But that said, a lot of the people in the room were real foodies too.
Okay.
And so they knew a lot, and a lot of them are great cooks. So it wasn't like I was the lone wolf, but sometimes I would want to weigh in and I wouldn't.
There's a job that I invented in my head because I would be so good at it and no one would ever want it. But like a script consultant who, when they write the first draft and there's food in it, they go to a food person and they're like, do we get this right? And you're like, no, absolutely not. You clearly don't know what gelato is.
You could do that. I think it's a great job for you.
Oh, okay. Well, here's my job application, everybody. If anyone can get me that job.
Well, I feel like certain shows, like medical shows, do really have like medical consultants.
Yes, but that's because it's science, and everyone, even if they don't know it, they take science more seriously.
But I do think if there ever is a show, I don't think there is one on TV right now that's about food in that same way.
That's
true. But if there were, I think you would be great to have in the room.
First of all, thank you.
You're welcome.
Second of all, do you remember the 13 episodes of Kitchen Confidential starring Bradley Cooper?
I remember when that came out. I didn't watch it. I don't know why.
It was so good.
Was it good?
It was actually good.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. I need to watch it.
I wonder if they had anyone consulting on that.
I'm sure they did.
You would
sure.
think.
Yeah.
I want to watch it again. There were so many.
Was it really good?
John Cho was on it.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
okay,
yeah,
watch it.
Yeah. I don't know where you can find it, but you should.
I'm sure it's there somewhere. Yeah.
Okay. So when we were emailing, you said that your main favorite food was pasta, which is kind of general, you know.
Well, I make it all the time. Uh-huh. So like my favorite food specifically is probably dried pasta with some kind of sauce that gets like sucked into it
with
cheese on top.
Okay. Yeah. And so I'm getting an idea of where you're at with pasta by the way you even describe that, because I think that the first thing we have to gauge is like your level of pasta snobbery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you have strong opinions about when a certain size of noodle should be used?
Well, no. And in fact, I would say I'm not a pasta snob by any means. In fact, like my lodestar, is that the right word? Am I Mike Pence now? my lodestar is the Prego jarred sauce that my mom would dump onto like overboiled fusilli growing up.
Okay.
And like that's so comforting for me, that if I make fusilli with like a red sauce and just make that and put a little Parmesan on it, like that to me is as good as going to Alimento or going to Mozza and having the most refined, beautiful egg pasta with, you know, truffle shaved on it. It's just because it's so nostalgic.
I see. Right. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. Like, I know my mom's spaghetti isn't like, we called it spaghetti bolognese.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, but I like it.
Right.
A lot.
Yeah. And that's great.
Yeah.
What was it?
It had like mushrooms and stuff in it. She's someone who never looks at recipes, but is a very good cook and is very good at like just seeing what's in the fridge and making stuff up. So I'm not even sure it was always the exact same thing, but lots of times it was ground beef because we lived in the suburbs of Seattle.
Oh, wow.
So what else are you going to do?
Okay. Really? Yeah.
This was not when, people were fancy about their grocery stores.
But, so you do love that dish?
Like, yes, I love that. And I love the real version also,
which
we talk about with Shirley Chung in a different episode.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
But isn't that amazing, like just how childhood can color things in such a specific way?
Yeah.
Like, you know, that just that simple, like even just Prego, like by itself, like I would probably really enjoy it. Maybe I'll go buy some after this.
Yeah. Well, you should. You should find out if you still can deal with it. Because there's some stuff that I'm like, oop, don't like that anymore. But other things that I'll always like.
Well, like my mom would buy me these rainbow cookies. They're like red, yellow, and green cookies with chocolate. I'm sure you've seen them in Jewish delis. They're like the tri-colored cookies.
Yeah.
And to me, that's still like my favorite cookie. Like if I see that somewhere, just like all the bells go off. And I don't necessarily think it's a great cookie,
right?
But it's because that's like what I ate growing up.
Yeah, so exactly. Food memories are great.
Yeah.
So we were talking before we started recording about whether we can call this episode pasta noodles.
Mm-hmm.
It does sound very childish, pasta noodles.
And I got yelled at once. I was telling you earlier by Chef Michael White in New York when I cooked with him for the cookbook that I did. I called his pasta noodles and he like snapped at me and was just like, no, like this is pasta. It's not noodles. Never call it noodles. Which I think he was saying that noodles were Asian.
I feel like that's just semantics and that's not a universal. Like there's probably like Italian people who would just call it noodles because they're not thinking about any
maybe,
other kind of
but if
noodles?
You like see a restaurant like that place that opened in Silver Lake, I like noodles. What's that place called?
I think it. We have noodles.
We have noodles.
Yeah.
But then I would assume that that's Asian noodles. And I think it is, right?
I haven't been to that place because they have like a noodle dish from every country. And I'm like, well, you can't possibly be doing any of those right. I've heard I'm wrong. I've heard it's very good.
Oh, is it good?
Yeah.
Well, maybe that refutes my point. If they have a noodle dish from every country, maybe that speaks to the fact that noodles are as universal
right.
as a word.
I know.
Okay.
I know.
But look, we can talk about pasta noodles. I'm okay with it.
Okay.
Just as long as we're acknowledging that some people might get very upset by this.
Right. Right. Which happens. People, if I title it pasta noodles, people are going to yell at me on Twitter without actually listening to the episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That you can count on.
Okay. That happens anyway.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing if you get people angry. It means people, you made them care about something.
Sometimes the angriest people are also objectively wrong, mm-hmm. which it's so rare in life that you can say you're objectively wrong. Mm-hmm. But that's happened to me before where someone came at me on Twitter and I didn't even respond because I was like, I don't know where to start with you because you're wrong.
Okay.
This isn't even a conversation.
Yeah.
I don't know, whatever. Okay, so you're not snobby about pasta, but you have a deep appreciation for it.
I have a deep love for it.
Love for it.
Yeah, I will always want to eat pasta. Always. Like, I could eat it right now. I could mm-hmm. eat it tomorrow. I have to like, control my desire for eating pasta. So, like, I will give myself 2 nights a week that I'm allowed to have it.
That's so reasonable. I remember growing up, the food pyramid mm-hmm. was in play.
Yeah.
And it recommended 6 to 11 servings of grain.
Oh.
It was such a glorious time.
Well, I've met people in LA who are like, do you ever do lentil pasta? Mm. That defeats the purpose for me.
It tastes different
mm-hmm. and it's like there's something about the pleasure of eating something that's a little bit forbidden or a little naughty.
Okay.
I mean, if you try to make it healthy, then it sort of takes away the fun of it mm-hmm. for me.
Mm-hmm.
That said, though, I mean, I've made whole wheat pasta and I've mm-hmm. tried that stuff, but mm-hmm. I still like the white flour stuff.
It is interesting how sometimes even like store-bought dried pastas can taste a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Trader Joe's pasta is sweet.
Okay, I've never had it.
It's very sweet.
Like, I'll go now to like fancy stores and buy like imported Italian dried pasta mm-hmm. and use that in my cooking, and I'll feel very like sophisticated for doing that.
Sure.
But truthfully, blindfolded, I probably wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's fair. What about things that usually are American, sometimes Japanese inventions that they don't really go for in Italy, like the classic example being spaghetti and meatballs?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any opinions on the correctness of that?
No, but I think my favorite thing about making pasta, and I think this is the classic Italian technique, is like making a sauce in a pan, adding the pasta to it, and then letting it soak in the sauce. So I think with meatballs, you're just kind of missing that integration
yeah.
and that kind of marriage of all the ingredients. So it's fine. Like, I enjoy spaghetti and meatballs, you know, I think it has its place, but I think the Italian method mm-hmm. of making even a meat sauce, like a bolognese, and then having the pasta soak it in
mm-hmm.
just makes more intuitive sense in terms of marrying all the flavors yeah. and textures.
Yeah. Okay.
I think I made you a bolognese once, didn't
I? Is that what you mean? It was the, was it Marcella Hazan?
Oh, yeah,
recipe?
It was.
Was
yeah,
it bolognese or was
yeah,
it
because our friend Marcos requested it.
Yes.
And then he brought the illustrious Catherine over and I had to serve it to her, but she seemed to enjoy it, I think.
I did.
Okay.
I know, and I was an official food editor at the time.
I know. It was very intimidating.
Yeah.
I was scared.
Were you really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, of course. I mean, like, it's your profession. And
yeah, but also you're a good cook, and also when I'm off the clock, I'm like, who cares? Like, if someone's going to cook you dinner, my God, that's just so nice in of itself.
I once cooked for Besha Rodel when she was the food critic for LA Weekly. Mm-hmm. And I guess you were editing her. and I was so scared. I was just terrified. She was a food critic. I was like...
Right.
And I think I annoyed the hell out of her because I was like, is it okay? Like, is it too salty? I mean, chicken. I think I was like, is it too salty? And she's like, no, it's fine. Like, and I think she just wanted to be a normal person.
Right.
And not be thought of that way.
Right. And I, from my point of view too, like... The critic is the person who has to care more about how things taste, whereas mm-hmm. I have slightly different interests.
Right.
Yeah.
You're thinking more about like the context
yeah.
and the culture. And
yeah, which sometimes critics do too. It's just like your brain is, as a reporter versus an editor, is like in a slightly different place.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I keep taking you off subject.
Off subject is great. I don't even know if anyone ever cares about the subject. They love all the like gossipy stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That was some good gossipy stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay. But just to indulge you, we'll talk about history now.
No, I'm happy to talk about anything. Yeah.
So as we've kind of talked about, like we're talking about the noodles of the West.
Okay, yes.
We'll say pasta is the noodles of the West.
Very good. I think that's good. Yeah.
And so the earliest Western-ish reference to pasta is in the 5th century in books found in Jerusalem. And then starting after that, for the few hundred years after that, they talked about pasta in Arabic writing, but they often used Persian words for it.
Okay.
So it sort of seems like it's like a greater Middle East type of thing. And in fact, the most accepted theory these days about like how pasta came to be so Italian is that it was actually Arab people in Sicily, and then it spread to the rest of the boot from there.
Well, I know couscous is pasta. Is that
couscous is pasta, and couscous is generally eaten in more like North African food,
okay,
like the eastern part of the Mediterranean. And I think that a lot of people don't know that couscous is pasta. I know that when I was a kid, I didn't know it was pasta.
So North Africa. So, but is that, did it come from the same root, you think, as pasta?
Yeah, okay. I think using wheat that way.
Mm-hmm.
Although some people, I have like a section of it later in my notes, but some people don't think that couscous is pasta because it's like a slightly different technique.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It doesn't feel like pasta when you eat it.
No,
it feels like you're eating
doesn't.
Like barley or
right.
Farro or something.
Yeah, but exactly.
But it doesn't have the nutritional value.
No, because it is pastaized, but it does feel like you're eating individual grains mm-hmm. of things. I think I thought it was barley.
I like
for
the verb
sure.
pastaized.
Yeah.
That's great. I want to be pastaized. Maybe I'll become a gay pasta for Bertoli.
You should.
Okay.
That's actually a really good idea.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're out there doing sponsored content, get that money.
They should just base different shapes on different gay people.
That's hilarious.
Okay.
I love it. Do
we'll
it.
Have to start that campaign.
Yeah.
Kickstarter.
Okay. We have to talk about Marco Polo, but we mostly have to talk about him. Yes.
Okay.
But only to say, like, forget about him. He had nothing to do with anything. I think that the best piece of evidence that he did not bring noodles from China to Italy is the fact that he had the language to describe them
mm-hmm.
when he was writing about things. And he used the word that was used back then for lasagna to mean noodles.
Okay.
Ergo, they were already using pasta,
wow.
right?
Now, is this like a very controversial subject? Oh, it is for Italians, right?
Yeah, I think for Italians.
But is it for the Chinese? Like, are they?
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese want to, you know, when you're really good at something, you want to claim credit for
mm-hmm.
it. So they definitely, generally speaking, want to say that Italy found out about noodles from them.
Well, let me ask you, like, as somebody who lives in LA, because
mm-hmm.
we have such extraordinary, like, Chinese food
yeah.
here in the San Gabriel Valley with incredible noodles.
Yeah.
And then we have such incredible Italian food here. Do you find the experience of eating noodles, like, really good noodles,
mm-hmm.
to be a similar experience as eating really good pasta, or does it feel different to you?
I think it does feel different, but there's some things like, you know, dan dan mian,
mm-hmm.
which is like a peanut-based sauce
oh,
with
yeah.
meat in it, and it's like kind of like a bolognese. I think
mm-hmm.
I think maybe it does have a lot to do with the fixins,
right.
the toppings.
Although I think of those noodles as being more toothsome in a way. They're
mm-hmm.
like chewier.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But I don't know. I mean, for me, I guess it's more like a, like, did I enjoy it?
Oh, right. Yeah. No, it's interesting. I feel like maybe like I'm going out on a limb here. Interesting twists on like I was just thinking of the soup dumpling, you know, at Din Tai Fung here, which
mm-hmm.
is kind of mellow. So that totally defeats my theory that Asian flavors are spicier, but then you have Alimento makes its it's brodo, you know what I'm talking about,
which
it's
oh,
like oh yeah
the tortellini and
brodo, but that's a riff sort of on a soup dumpling because it's they put the brodo inside the tortellini.
That's right. So he's being very Californian
yeah.
by like taking an old Italian dish and a not that old Chinese dish and
mm-hmm.
then like mashing them up into something new.
Which is actually a great sort of emblem of everything we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
The
I
best
feel like
food,
I redeemed myself somehow.
You never unredeemed yourself.
Okay, good.
You're good.
I always get nervous when I talk about things I don't know that much about. So
who wouldn't? You'd be such a jerk if you didn't.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not good with history, so there we go.
Well, that's the thing that I'm supposed to be good
oh,
at.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So.
There you go.
So there's record of pasta being produced commercially in Italy by about 1400. They talk about mostly around like the greater Naples area. They called all dried pasta apparently vermicelli.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the fresh pasta, and we'll get to the the difference and the issues around fresh pasta later, but that has eggs in it. So that tends to be more of a northern dish because they're just wealthier mm-hmm. in the north and they have more animal products to put in things.
Okay.
So the dried pasta versus fresh pasta isn't actually a quality issue, which I think a lot of Americans mistake it for.
This is access to eggs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And a different usage of it.
That's actually very helpful because that's like, I feel like the southern Italian dishes that I make are like spaghetti with like brighter, you know, like seafood and things like that.
Absolutely.
And then the northern Italian are like the richer, like mm-hmm. egg noodles with truffles.
It's much more French.
Yeah.
They're into cream sauces up mm-hmm. in the north. And I think it's not often what we think of as Italian food because it was mostly southern Italians who immigrated to American.
Mm-hmm.
So like red sauce Italian.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Wow. Okay. I'm learning every second of this podcast.
It's hooray. Yeah. So they would actually knead the dough by foot.
Oh.
Yeah.
Just adds an umami flavor to
you
it.
You get it. Yeah.
Okay.
And then they had the huge extruders that had to be like reverse, like the pasta would be pulled through the extruder by either a bunch of dudes or a horse or two. Do you, if you make pasta at home, do you ever make it from scratch?
I have. I have a crank machine that you do by mm-hmm. hand, but then my friend Diana very generously gave me her KitchenAid attachment, which is incredible.
Oh, okay.
And I can literally like make pasta whenever I want to, and it would be so easy, but I just don't do it.
Right.
So
when you have made it, did you specifically use semolina?
No, I think I just used all purpose.
Okay. So I guess semolina lends it, among other things, that like slight yellow color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think for me, like the fun aspect of using all purpose is like it shows you that you can just make pasta easily if you want to.
Yeah.
So it's like you can just take some all purpose, take some eggs, mix it all together. In fact, Lydia Bastianich has an amazing food processor recipe.
Uh-huh.
You just put eggs, it's just like a certain ratio of flour, eggs, water, and olive oil. And you just blitz it in your food processor, wrap it in plastic wrap, let it sit for an hour, and then crank it through. And it's pretty fantastic.
Oh,
so
interesting.
It shouldn't be that intimidating to make.
Right.
But somehow most people don't want to make it.
Well, you know, and like people will tell these lies like if you don't use semolina, it'll be terrible and the worst thing that you ever served your family,
yeah,
et cetera.
No, I don't think so. No. I think what's really cool about making fresh pasta is just the texture is just so smooth. And it really did feel different. I think I made this recipe that I watched her make on PBS that was with cheche beans. So it was like garbanzo beans. Mm-hmm. But it was like lasagna sheets. So you kind of cranked it through, just cut it into squares.
Mm-hmm.
Then you cook chickpeas in this like brothy mixture of like chicken stock and garlic and onions and carrots. And then you kind of add the lasagna sheets to like the stewy mixture and you add tons of Parmesan cheese. It was kind of crazy. It was delicious.
Oh. Yeah, so, it sounds good.
Yeah, I just want to make you hungry.
Add tons of Parmesan cheese. All
yeah,
right.
It always works. Yeah. No, if your pasta's not good, just add a ton of Parmesan cheese.
Yeah.
It'll be fine.
And then butter. You're set.
Yeah.
Yeah. Butter. You know, weird tangent, but whatever. I always think about, there was an episode of Mad Men where he's having an affair with, I think, the first grade teacher, one of his kids' teachers.
Okay. Yeah.
And she talks about how she wants them to go on a date to Little Italy mm-hmm. in Manhattan, and she wants to eat pasta with cheese and butter.
Okay.
And I remember online afterwards, people being like, oh, butter, what does she know? They didn't know anything in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And that always made me crazy because actually butter is used in Northern Italy.
Oh, yeah. It's a key ingredient in cacio e pepe, which I think is what maybe she wanted.
Well, she only said cheese and butter, but who knows what she wanted? Yeah. The point is she wasn't wrong to want butter on her pasta.
And in fact, I think butter is like one of the great secret agents in like making your pasta amazing because...
Yeah.
First of all, I think like places like Alimento add butter to their pasta. Like, I think it's when you go to a restaurant, you have an amazing pasta dish. I think they've probably added butter because it just emulsifies the mm-hmm. sauce and it marries it to the noodles and it just makes everything glisten and shine.
The thing about restaurant food is that it has like at least 3 times as much butter and salt as you anticipate it.
Which is
having.
The funniest thing with my family because my parents eat out at restaurants every night and my mom tries to eat healthy at restaurants. So she'll order the salmon and she'll be like, oh, you know, I'm eating healthy. I'm having the salmon. And meanwhile, she watches me cook at home and I'll put like a tablespoon of butter because I saw the butter you're putting to your pasta. And it's like, mom, like you're eating like a stick of butter when you eat that salmon, but they won't acknowledge that.
Right. Oh my gosh. That's so much like my grandma. She'll like wince when you use ingredients in cooking.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's so funny because people, it's like a cognitive dissonance thing. Like
yes.
People don't want to know what goes into their food and they want to believe that what they're eating is healthy and untouched. And that's not true.
No, never. Absolutely not. That's why it tastes good.
Yeah.
So this vermicelli that apparently they were calling it was kind of spaghetti-ish. Okay. So let's just start calling it spaghetti. But it was way longer than any spaghetti that you could buy now. And they would sell it from stalls. They would just like hand you a couple handfuls of spaghetti and then there would be Romano cheese.
Okay.
And you'd mix it together. Now, for whatever reason, they didn't use utensils for this. So it was like, pick up a huge long strand of spaghetti and drop it in your mouth from above.
Okay.
Apparently.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, I know. And the reason they know about it, because back in the era of the Grand Tour, when rich British people would go tour the continent, mm-hmm. and they would go to Naples and they would do like the locals and eat the spaghetti. This was part of their myth about Italian people being crude.
Okay.
And uncultured.
Interesting.
They said they don't even have utensils.
Okay.
Italians do have utensils, have for as long as the rest of the Europeans have. Maybe we're even some of the first Europeans to use forks. But for whatever reason, with this long ass spaghetti, they were like, we'll eat it with our hands.
But it's so funny because it's like, now I feel we can see that as Italians being more in touch with their senses and being more sensual.
They are so sensual.
Yeah. I wrote this cookbook called Secrets of the Best Chefs, where I cooked with all these different chefs, and I got to cook with Asha Gomez, who's a Indian chef in Atlanta who cooks kind of fusion Indian Southern food.
Cool.
And she had a restaurant for a while, and then she has a book called My Two Souths, which are about being from Southern India and being from the South. But I bring her up because she made this whole meal based on her childhood in Kerala, mm-hmm. with a yogurt rice and this braised meat. And then when we sat down to eat it, she said, no utensils. Like, you'll use your fingers, you'll grab a little rice, uh-huh. you'll grab a little meat. And, you know, it felt like a novelty at first, but then when we did it totally changed the experience of eating it because it was so much more sensual. You were just so much more connected to what you were eating. So
interesting.
I think those Grand Tour people didn't know what they were missing.
No, on a lot of ways,
yeah.
I'm sure. I wonder if it comes around actually to being healthier to eat with your hands, because as you mentioned, like, you're so much more in tune with it, mm-hmm. and like being in tune with your body is something that like we probably in modern society don't know how to do anymore. Like,
yeah.
Our rhythms are all messed up from our TVs and our smartphones and everything like
totally.
That.
And also I think, you know, there's also this fear of disease and mm-hmm. fear of contamination that I think weirdly is unhealthy. It's like introducing a little bacteria into your body is yeah. probably good for you.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely. Yeah. And we're always confused about what's going to make you sick. I remember growing up, so at least in the 90s when I was in high school and aware of these things, it's because I lived in Seattle, which is when I was in fifth grade was where the Jack in the Box E. coli thing that killed a lot of people
yeah.
happened. So I think the idea in the 90s was that like meat will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
But in the rest of the world, and now starting to be in America, it's produce.
Right. Oh, yeah. Lettuce.
Yeah.
I'm scared of lettuce in a bag.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. I buy it, but I'm scared of it.
Which I think is actually totally reasonable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think eating your own hand, Phil,
yeah.
is much less dangerous than like food that you don't know what happened to it on its way to your house.
As somebody who cooks all the time too, like, I'm constantly touching food.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. So if I have dinner guests over and I'm plating a salad, like, I'll be in the kitchen like, you know, putting my hands all through the Caesar salad and
yeah.
like putting it on the plate with my hands, and I'll catch someone's eye. I'll be like, oh, are they freaked out right now? Like, should I be wearing gloves? I'm not a restaurant. I'm a person. You know, this is how I do it for me. But I'm also
yeah.
aware of how like hyper-conscious people are about people touching their food.
Yes. No, but do you remember a couple years ago, for about 2 seconds, California made it illegal for sushi chefs to touch
yes.
the sushi with their bare hands?
I do remember that.
And
yes.
I don't know if you felt the same way, but I was like, whoever introduced this bill and whoever is passing it, like, is not a food lover.
Mm-hmm.
They're very much food as fuel people, and they don't get it.
That's why when I make the salad and I catch the dinner guest's
yeah.
eye, I'm aware of what they're thinking, which is like,
yeah.
ooh. So I think there's a certain perception that touching food with your hands is dirty and
yeah.
gross, and that it's not sanitary.
Two of my aunts couldn't be more different about this stuff, and one of them, whenever she has people over, you can see her touching the food with her hands all
okay.
the time, and the other aunt is like rocking back and forth in the corner,
oh, really?
Trying not to say anything but freaking out.
Yeah, it's strange. It's sort of a weird thing where sometimes it feels right and sometimes it feels wrong.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about like the different types of pasta.
Okay.
Pasta noodles, because
sure.
we're talking less about sauce, but
yes.
a little bit about sauce, because usually the shape of the noodles is, they're like, it's shaped like this because it's good for this kind of sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So like, for instance, short pasta,
mm-hmm.
let's say like ziti. That, even in Italy, is, I say even in Italy because I think baked pasta tends to be kind of an American thing. Like, we love macaroni and cheese so much more than Italians do. Mm-hmm. But it is made in baked pastas in Italy. And my guess is because it's kind of the same size of whatever other ingredients mm-hmm. you have in it. So it makes sense to have it in a casserole type item yeah. where it's just, you're just using a fork. And then other ones that have, I mean, ziti has ridges too, but you serve it with a meat sauce because ridges are meant to like pick up all the bits in the pasta.
Yeah, I think when people get worried about following the rules of this, mm-hmm. it's helpful to remember that it's just about pleasure.
Yeah,
it's just like you want to maximize your pleasure, so you yes. want to have the like noodles catch the sauce.
Right,
so you'll get more pleasure with each bite. It's not like you're gonna go to jail if you serve you know spaghetti with the wrong sauce. You know,
yeah.
But like if I make orecchiette with you know, I have this recipe I make with like broccoli and sausage, mm-hmm. like. So orecchiette is like little ears. Mm-hmm. I'll cut the broccoli like into small florets, and I'll break the sausage up into little bits. With yeah. the goal being that you get a little bit of sausage and a little bit of broccoli in each ear.
Yeah,
And so it's all about that harmony and that balance. But you wouldn't want like huge pieces of broccoli and mm-hmm. then little orecchiette. Mm-hmm. And then with like a bolognese, I think when you came over, I might have made rigatoni because I love the way rigatoni yeah. catches the sauce inside
yes.
of it.
Yes.
And so yeah, I think those things make sense.
Okay. All right. And then you can also tell a lot of times there's a couple kinds of pasta that you can tell are made in the north because of the rich ingredients. Filled pastas. Mm-hmm. If they're coming at you with meat already in the pasta, mm-hmm. that's rich people stuff.
Yeah. That does sound very rich. Yeah. I mean, there are so many recipes that I've never made before that have, you know, pancetta and mortadella mm-hmm. and all kinds of things inside the pasta. And it's like, I'll let a restaurant do that.
Right. Exactly.
That's not for me.
If yeah. it's too complicated, let someone who's getting paid for it. Do it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then this is the one that people get so uppity about, the bolognese mm-hmm. with tagliatelle right. specifically, which is long and flat, mm-hmm. whereas spaghetti is round.
Yeah, I think the flatness allows the bolognese to adhere more to it than the spaghetti, which it might slip off of.
Yeah, totally. That makes sense.
So.
That's the theory anyway.
Yeah.
Do you use a spoon for long pasta? Mm-mm. As a support utensil?
I mean, no. I'm not against it. I just don't personally do that. But I also don't... there's that whole thing of like slurping like a big noodle. Like Lydia Bastianich says, never break your spaghetti in half when you put it in the pot.
I didn't know that that was even a thing people would do because... Okay, growing up, I didn't even think about it. But mm-hmm. if you buy a certain type of pasta, eat it the way it's presented.
Right.
And I never thought about it until one day in college... My worst roommate mm-hmm. was making spaghetti for like everybody, and the water's boiling and she goes to put the spaghetti over the pot and she cracks the whole thing in half.
Yeah.
And I caught another roommate, and we were just, you know, 20-year-old idiots, but mm-hmm. I caught another roommate's eye and both of us were like, oh my God.
All right.
Without even knowing it, I knew that that was wrong.
Well, I think what she says, people do that because they don't realize that the pasta will eventually sink into the boiling water and get fully cooked. So they're doing it so that it just gets submerged immediately.
I guess, but if you ever cook spaghetti correctly once, yeah. you'll see how quickly it drops into the water.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think it's interesting because like in, you know, Asian cultures, there's that pride in slurping your noodles
yeah.
and not, but I'm like so neurotic that I'm going to choke while I'm eating. I always bite it off with my teeth.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if in Italian culture, you're supposed to like eat the full strand of noodle the same way, you know, slurp your whole spaghetti up.
I think you are. Winston's being so cute.
Oh, is Winston wants some attention?
Yes.
He wants some pasta probably.
Yeah, he does.
Winston, what are you
oh
doing?
Oh my God.
You want to be on this podcast? Oh, he's like, he probably wants to go for a walk is probably what's
yeah.
happening.
Yeah. When don't they want to go for walks?
I don't know. Winston.
So, okay. Let's say that you had a recipe that called for a certain kind of pasta. Okay. If you... needed a long and textured noodle,
mm-hmm.
would it be better to swap it out? And you didn't have that. Would it be better to swap it out for a short textured noodle or a smooth long noodle? Are the ridges or the length the more important?
What's an example of a long pasta with a textured noodle?
So those are a little more rare in America, but
okay.
there's some that have like the one with the, like, it's kind of ribbony.
I know what you're
on
talking
the sides.
About. I've never cooked with that. So
yeah.
I haven't had that situation come up. So to answer your question, I would use a short textured pasta for something where you want there to be texture attached to the sauce.
So the texture is more important than like the length.
I think
of
so.
It.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, we were talking about ziti before, and then there's penne, and then there's like penne rigate, which has the ridges. So if I'm making like a simple tomato sauce with like chili flakes and like stuff, like I'll get the one with ridges because then that just catches more than just the penne.
Okay. All right. Pastini are the tiny ones, which we touched on a little bit before.
I like that in soup.
Which, okay, I thought that the, like, stars, chicken and stars and that kind of stuff, I thought that those tiny shapes in the little circles were totally American, like Campbell's or Chef Boyardee. They're not. No. They're totally authentically Italian.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can make minestrone with it. You can, yeah, and it's great. It's a great way to kind of add some body to your soup because not only does it add the, like, the pasta itself, but the starch comes off of the pasta while you add it to the soup, so it thickens the soup. So it's always a good idea to add pasta. However, you can't leave it in your soup overnight or it will suck up all your soup and then you'll just end up with a bowl of mushy pasta and vegetables.
These are really good tips.
Oh, thanks. That's what I get paid the big dollars to write my newsletter.
Exactly.
Not really. Nobody pays me to do that.
It's not subscription? I mean, a paid subscription?
No.
Okay.
It's free. Oh, yeah, it's free. Sign
Look at
up
you.
For free. MailChimp.
You're just doing things because you enjoy them.
I know.
I don't even know.
For now,
what the...
we'll see. I'll start charging down the line. Sure.
Right. First people to sign up get it for free.
Yeah. I think newsletters are all free, aren't they? You can.
No.
Oh, they're not?
No, absolutely not. A lot of people charge $5 a month.
Ooh.
And there are some that are industry specific. I was talking to one guy who has like a business of the entertainment industry newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
He charges $50 a month.
Really?
Yes. Now, having said that, you know that like everyone's charging it to their company. And I think that's why he can charge $50 a month.
If
you're an agent, you're subscribing
to it.
Yeah, you can.
Well, unfortunately, like mine's just more like a journal. So I don't know what people would pay for, but maybe people will fall so in love with it that they'll pay $50 a month to keep reading it.
Exactly.
Or maybe not. Maybe I'll just do it for the love. That's why I do everything that I do.
Yes. So the biggest one about the different kinds of pasta, fresh versus dried.
Mm-hmm.
Are you comfortable subbing in one for the other?
Yes. I mean, I use dried 99% of the time because it's just easier. And also, you know, the kind of food that I make at home is, I just try to keep it casual. I mean, you know, I love going to the farmer's market, getting like great vegetables and things. And then, yeah, using whatever dried pastas I have. That said, like, it's fun to make fresh pasta, but I don't think you need to worry about that as a home cook necessarily,
right.
Unless you want to. I mean, I don't think there's a should that should hover over your...
I just think there's this lingering sense that I feel like started in the 90s. I always think everything started in the 90s, but that's when I was gaining consciousness. So that's probably what it means.
Yeah. Okay.
That fresh pasta was fancier.
And I don't... think, well, it's more effort.
Sure. But I remember it being a thing like any pasta dish. It was like, oh, and we got fresh pasta for it. I don't think people were considering why they thought it was fancier.
I just had a memory. I had a roommate in law school. I accidentally went to law school. That's another story for another time. But I remember she didn't like me to meddle when she cooked and things because I was still learning how to cook and she probably thought I was being annoying. And I remember she bought fresh pasta and she was making it for herself. And I remember she was on the phone and she like put it in the pot and it was boiling. And I was like, oh boy, she is overcooking that. But she like kept it going. And then like 20 minutes later, she took it out and it was just like this disgusting mess, which I took great pleasure in because she should have asked me and I would have told her. So I guess the answer, the question, you know, the idea of, you know, whether it's fancy or not, I don't know, but I do know, don't cook it for too long.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Oh man. Okay. I hate angel hair pasta.
Yeah. I haven't had angel hair in a long time. I think I like it when it's like with a seafood kind of thing, but
I don't know what it is. I can't stand it. It must be textural.
Yeah.
Obviously. Do you have a pasta shape that you cannot abide? Or am I the weird one who's just like, not that shape?
A shape that I can't abide?
Yeah.
I wish I had an answer to this question. No, nothing is really coming to mind. I mean, as I said earlier, I just love pasta.
I
will eat it in all shapes, all sizes. I mean, I don't get the rainbow pasta necessarily that they sell in novelty shops. Like,
no.
Is that just a lot of food coloring in your pasta?
Yeah. What's the point? It doesn't matter.
Yeah. That I'm not into. And then penis-shaped pasta and boob-shaped pasta for like bachelor parties. And like, I just think that's, you know, a little much.
I agree.
Yeah.
Who needs it?
Yeah.
Plus, it must get purchased so rarely that that's probably like three-year-old pasta.
Yes. Which but is... the proper sauce for a penis-shaped pasta is a bolognese, FYI.
Oh, yeah. That is good to know.
Yeah, bolognese.
Oh, I didn't even get that. Yeah, I just said that. Do you have a great joke. Do you have a favorite noodle and sauce combo? I thought about this a long time, and I'm just springing this on you.
Well, I mean, my standard is to, like, okay, like, if I was going to make pasta tonight, I have cans of tomatoes, and I have, like, fusilli, I have, like, penne. And what I love to do is just, like, see what I have around. So, like, I have eggplant in the refrigerator so I can make a pasta alla norma. But generally, like, my combo, like, the classic combo for me would probably be, like, a penne or a ziti or a fusilli with, like, some kind of red sauce with either eggplant in it or capers or anchovies or just, like, sort of that kind of world.
You're kind of doing like a Calabrian, like Southern Italy type thing.
And I'll break it up with a cauliflower sometimes. I'll do broccoli and some, you know, and then sometimes I'll do a totally different thing and I'll do like the cacio e pepe, which I have a great recipe for from Mark Ladner. It was in Bon Appetit. Where you basically toast the peppercorns in a hot skillet while you boil the spaghetti. And then you lift a ladleful of the salty pasta water into the thing with the hot skillet with the peppers. And it like sizzles and spurts and goes crazy. And then you add butter to that and make what's called a liaison. And so it's sort of like a saucy, buttery, peppery, salty pasta sauce. And then you add your spaghetti to that. And then you add a ton of cheese. And it's amazing.
That does sound amazing.
It's so good. So it's a great technique. I mean, it's a little scary when you add a ladleful of pasta water to the hot skillet with the peppers.
Make the children leave the room.
Yeah. And in fact, like, I don't think it needs to be that scary. I think you can not necessarily toast it on high heat. You can like lower the heat, which I've learned subsequently. But that's a great one to make. And I love making that.
That does sound good. And that's Roman. And I think my favorite is Roman.
Okay.
Specifically bucatini carbonara.
And do you make yours with raw eggs and
I go for raw eggs. I don't care, whatever. Great. 1000%. And for anyone who's not familiar with bucatini, imagine like a thick spaghetti but with a hole running through it. And that way there's sauce inside and outside of it.
And it's known for like being unwieldy and like splattering all over you when you slurp it up.
Because it's so long and it's
floppy.
There's just so much going on, but it's so good.
It's delicious.
It's so good.
What's your favorite place to get pasta in LA?
For a long time, it was Osteria La Buca.
Oh, that's great.
On Melrose. But that was when they had the first chef, and I don't know if it's still that good. And then also, not that I can ever afford to go there, but when I was still at LA Weekly and had other people paying for my food, I went to Rosso Blu downtown.
Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, so good.
It's really good. I only went there once and I loved it. I should go back right now.
I mean, I would love to go back. That is, I feel like it might be the most high-end restaurant in Los Angeles.
Oh, interesting.
Like high-end, on the west side, there's some places that are just expensive.
Yeah.
But that's like really expensive and you understand why.
Have you been to Felix?
I never have. That's all the way in Venice. When am I going
to
get there?
I finally went because I'm such a pasta freak. I have to go. And it was great. But I remember the late Jonathan Gold wouldn't put on his 99 list because he said they cooked their pasta a certain way that he didn't approve of. He thought it was too toothsome for pasta, which was so fascinating. And I don't know enough about Italian pasta culture to even know what he, because he referred to a specific style that Evan Funk makes his pasta in that he doesn't approve of that style.
That's hilarious. Yes,
but I loved it. I thought it was great.
And we can't ask the man himself, but I would bet $1 million that there was something else going on there. Why he wouldn't put him on the list.
Maybe, yeah. Who knows? Who knows? I have no idea. But I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. But it is very far.
Yeah. But for anyone who's visiting in LA and is staying on the west side, you can go to Felix instead of Rosso Blu.
And you can go at 5:30 because you're not going to get a reservation. But if you just show up at 5:30, they'll seat you at the bar.
Which that is a hot tip.
Yeah.
That's great. There you
go. I'm full of hot tips. Only about pasta, though.
Well, probably all other foods, which is why you want people to sign up for your newsletter.
Let's not push it. I mean, I just started doing it again. Who knows? I'll probably burn out in like 2 weeks. Be on the streets.
Well, you're a really good Instagrammer, so where can people at least find you on Instagram?
On Instagram, I'm Amateur Gourmet. On Twitter, I'm Hey Adam Roberts.
Okay.
And then my newsletter is the Amateur Gourmet newsletter, and you can find a link to it on both Twitter and Instagram.
Perfect. Yeah. Adam, thank you so much for sharing all of your cooking tips with us.
This was a pleasure.
Awesome.
Thank you, Catherine. The money turned into a monster.